Well, after all these years, it is certainly a blessing that we can be together. And I want to tell you how deeply I appreciate your wonderful friendship and your wonderful support and cooperation over all these years. May all of you have a truly wonderful Christmas, and may we all together in the new year see a real advancement on all levels of society of the dreams and principles which we know to be true. Bless all of you. And some time ago, Jowett, who is one of the principal translators of Plato, commenting on the writings of Homer, said that he believed that Homer wrote the Odyssey and the Iliad before the establishment of the Greek mysteries. This seems unlikely, however, because much of the story that has come down to us from so many different sources is to be found in a short section of Homer's work called The Cave of the Nymphs. This is the story of the mysterious cavern presided over by immortal mortals. This cave was at an entrance into birth, and all creatures were born with the sun in Cancer. They then entered into the mysteries of the cave, descended to its lowest parts, ascended a ladder that brought them to the gate of exit in the sign of Capricorn. So in the ancient rites, there's no question that Homer was aware of some of the esoteric speculations of Far Asia and of the earlier Western cultures. This today we are worshiping, recognizing, and reviving one of the most ancient beliefs of mankind, the annual birthday of the sun. This has been regarded with sacredness from time immemorial. There is no people anywhere that has not passed through some phase of solar symbolism in their philosophies, their sciences, and their theologies. It has dominated all the arts. It has become involved in all harmonic theories of music. And the annual birthday of the sun is the most celebrated and sacred of all festivals throughout the world. We find records of it everywhere because it represents to the average believer the annual restoration of life and becomes a symbol of the grand resurrection in which all things in all conditions and all types of existence come finally to the great redemption, to the restoration, to the lifting up of all life from darkness to light. It is obvious that this belief originated in the Northern Hemisphere because all of the calculations, symbolisms, and devices involved in the rites are obviously related to a sun motion from the lower to the northern hemisphere of light. So here somewhere, maybe in India, maybe in China, this concept regained its most primitive acceptance. But very premier times, when there was nothing but savagery in the world, when men feared darkness and lived only in light, where night was a terror and day a resurrection and a relief. All of these facts and principles and ideas have come down to us in our modern philosophies, our modern religions, and even to a touch of our modern sciences. Because so much of knowledge has been based upon an astronomical mystery, the mystery of the calendar, the mystery of time and of days, the cycles of years, the feasts and various rituals attendant upon various seasons of the year, the harvest, the planting, all of these things were controlled by a fixed system of religion. All of the good things of earth come from one good thing, which is life itself. Now, the sun in its beginnings came to be understood or recognized as synonymous with life. That which the sun represented was alive. The sun was alive. And because it was alive, it could give life. It could propagate life. It could restore life. It could revive the lives and things that were fading or failing. The sun was basically life. And this life was the common property of us all. The great benefit, the immense gift, the unchallenged mightiness upon which we all depend. From the tiniest atom to the greatest star, light is a symbol of the presence of life. Therefore, this light is a promise. It tells us something that we must all come to understand, that this light is not something that came from nothing. It is not something which was suddenly lit in some generation or age. It was eternal. Therefore, life is eternal. Immortality is a certainty. Growth is inevitable. For all good things, all revelations are based upon the immediate and inevitable and eternal presence of life. Life is therefore a very sacred thing. And as we watch its descent through all the orders of creation, we find that it comes finally to become shared with the human being. There is life in us, and this life in us has built its tabernacle of the flesh. It is this inner life that moves all parts of the outer life, because without this light, this tremendous power, all futility would go on forever hopelessly. Therefore, we have great important thought of the importance of life. Therefore, every scripture in the world has told us to protect life. It has told us and warned us not to destroy life, rather not to destroy the houses which it builds, to cooperate with it. For within this light, we also have all the laws of light. And the laws of life are the commandments. They are the ways, they are the principles, they are the methods by means of which light accomplishes its perfect works. Therefore, to damage or destroy the channels of light, or the channels of life, such is a serious crime against eternity. Therefore, we must also remember that in the religions of mankind, there was a basic nature worship. Now, nature worship is not exactly what we sometimes think it is in terms of nature cults and things of this nature. Nature worship is the adoration of the realities of things. It is to look out upon the great breadths and depths of existence with gratitude, with humble wonder, and with a deep and abiding resolution to learn the lessons of light and life, that we may in due time become useful and valuable servants in this house of eternal effulgency. All religions, then, have had their light gods, and these light gods are all love gods. They are deities that protect, preserve, and elevate, lift up, and redeem every form of life in nature. Among the most interesting, perhaps, of these light gods and life gods was Horus, the beloved son of Osiris, the god of the Egyptians. The story of the rites of the Egyptian mysteries, the story is so similar to our own that it does not pay us to overlook it, because it also contains certain secrets, as these are set forth in the ancient rites and rituals of the rites of Memphis. In the days of long ago, Osiris, the father god, the principal eternal light, the guardian and protector of peoples and nations and races, decided that the time had come to establish a covenant upon the earth. And he sent to the earth his only begotten son, Horus. the firstborn of the light god. And this Horus became the defender of the faith and established the mysteries. And the symbol of this deity was the sun ball, the symbol of infinite life. And one of the symbols of this deity was the Scarabaeus Sacus, the beetle, which was the symbol of the sun itself being rolled across the sky by the eternal power. And Horus became the symbol of the sun deity. And he sat in a ship, and this ship sailed across the sky in the daytime. And at night it went down and sailed through the underworld, so that the spirits in darkness might also have their light. The Egyptians did not know the heliocentric system as we do, but it is interesting that they had become aware of the fact that the sun's light was somewhere when it wasn't here, and regularly came up at the same time according to the seasons. So instead of saying that it was on the other side of the earth, the Egyptians thought of it as in the underworld or a subterranean part of the world, so that it passed through the darkness and brought peace to the souls that were troubled in the mysterious Amentet of the afterlife. And Horus became the avenger of his father. And when Horus became the Redeemer, he was the Lord of the Shesesti, the Lord of the Sons of Light. And in the great battle between darkness and light, Horus led the hosts of heaven and overcame the dark adversary of winter and brought about in due time the bright light of spring. Everywhere these legends mix and mingle and fall together in patterns that give us a great deal of material for careful thought. Now this light that we know somewhere shining forever has also been distributed through living things as the source of individual life, individual light. And therefore both life and light come within, from within us. And the great light, life's core within us is the human heart. It is in the heart that forever the drum of the gods is beating. It is also in the heart that the drum of Shiva in India beats out the pulse beat that keeps us alive. Everywhere we look, we find symbols. And everywhere we find symbols, we find the story of the victorious sun, the mysterious universal light that lighteth everything that cometh into the world. And this life and this power is the life of men. It is the life of all creations. It is distributed through the blades of grass. It goes through every form of life. Therefore, in all analysis, all life is one life. And that one life is the eternal life light itself, the power of the divine in all creation. So as we come to the winter solstice, we come to the time in which the ancients be prepared for the day to come, where they looked through the stones of Stonehenge, or watch the shadows of the great pyramids. All these were to tell them the sacred moment, the divine instant in which life returned to the world. Now, of course, it is obvious that life did not entirely depart, for if it had, all things would have ended in the black or Kali Yuga of night. It didn't cease. It was diminished. It was diminished, and in this diminishing, left great problems unsolved. It also became a great moral force, for something was going on all the time that some of our forebears recognized, but we have more or less forgotten, and namely that the darkness or the night is our challenge. The powers of heaven give us light and light. They give us the day with all its glory, but it is in our own hearts and souls that we must transform the night into eternal day. When we do this, we are in the light of reality forever. All these thoughts passed through primitive minds, but these minds were very solemn and sacred in their thinking. They tried very hard to realize their utter dependence upon a divine power at the source of existence. They did not believe that they could stand alone. They did not believe that they could turn their backs upon the laws of heaven and build a world of their own. They did not believe in an atheistic culture or anything in which we did not trace our way back to the one truth, the one reality, the one inevitable. On our days, we kind of set aside Christmas as a symbol of giving. And each in his own way, from his own heart, does some giving. The gift of heaven is interpreted in our human lives by the gifts of kindness, by thoughtfulness, by compassion, and by a sharing for a moment some of the realities that have come to our own observation. We find, therefore, the symbol of generosity, and the generosity is the sharing, finally, of life, the sharing of light, the sharing of truth. The greatest gift that we can give to any living thing is a share of the reality that abides within ourselves. So in the old days and so forth and so on, the giving of Christmas, which became identified with St. Nicholas of Myra, was a universal mystery. Christmas was sacred, giving was sacred, sharing was sacred, long before Christianity began. But they did take this, as Irenaeus tells us, and they took the older symbolism and Christianized it. They explained that in reality, the ancient peoples were, in a sense, Christian people. They had the same teaching, the same essential reality, but they did not call it by the same name. They invented diverse symbols to represent the same truth that was to come to the world at the beginning of the Christian era. And so we have today the descent of the Christmas spirit by means of a psychological, astronomical theology, the symbol of the zodiac, the planets, and the great clock of eternity. If then we view it in this particular way, we will have some new thinking to do that will be valuable and useful to us. To the ancients, the great mysteries were birth and death. Birth was a coming forth into the obvious. Birth was an embodiment of an eternal life that existed both embodied and unembodied. Birth was a coming into manifestation of invisible principles and powers. Birth was a great and wonderful miracle which the wisest could study and the simplest could comprehend. It was something that was a constant manifestation of unknown realities. Even today, we have no full understanding of the mystery of a life coming into embodiment. We know its physical processes. We can analyze and time the various steps of the procedure. But how it starts in the very beginning, what is the mysterious flash of divine power that in some way comes forth out of the unknown? It is not in the bodies of the parents, it is not in the body of the child, but it is in the body of God, and all creatures, the parents and the child, are in the body of God. It is one mystery specialized in one of the great events of existence, the mystery of birth. And in this birth, the light of heaven begins to shine through. Many mothers have seen it in the eyes of their babies. We see it also as we go along. We see that the child is born closer to God than we are. We realize that its thoughts and its ideals and dreams are very wonderful, if fanciful, and in a strange way more practical than ours, and that in our process of trying to help this child to become part of society, we, in a way, diminish the eternity of it and limit it into the concepts of our own life way. So the child begins, and this is the mystery of the sign of Cancer, the entrance to the cave of the mysterious nymphs. And then it goes on around the zodiac halfway from Cancer to Capricorn. And in Capricorn, we have the symbol of death or transition. Now, we take it first as a transitional symbol. We see the various energies and resources of life gradually impaired. we find that the time comes when the body can no longer sustain the dreams, the ideals of the spirit. Also, that in various ways, through ignorance, we have damaged that body so that it becomes more and more impaired, and that which was to be a temple to the Most High becomes a prison to our own mistakes. These things we have to face. But the time comes when there is a mysterious resurrection which we call death. For death is really the going forth in light, according to the Egyptian ritual. To come forth by day is to come forth out of the darkness of our own limitations into the light of eternal truth. And beyond the grave, according to the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Persians, and the Chinese, there was not darkness, but light. All the darkness that there is here. And we immediately depart from it and come forth into the fullness. We come forth into the radiance of the celestial sun. So the Egyptians believed that what we call the Book of the Dead is really a misnomer. And the great Egyptologists of the modern world, like Budge, are aware that it is a misnomer. For the name of this sacred ritual, as performed in the rites of the Egyptians of the Osirian recension, is the Book of the Coming Forth by Day. And I know I talked to Dr. Budge Sr. in Chicago years ago when we were discussing the story of the Book of the Dead. And I said to him, Dr. Bustard, is there any evidence that this book was originally a drama, that it was performed by living actors within the precincts of the temples, that it is not simply a discussion of the afterlife, it is a great drama of the life cycle? Budge smiled. He said, it is certainly true, and I have seen copies, manuscripts of the Book of the Dead with the prompter's marks for the actors. It was a living drama, not merely a strange mythological account of something beyond our general understanding. And in this mystery of coming forth by day, we have the individual who goes forth in the light of truth. That the light within means that we retire not into darkness, but into light. And while the darkness may gather heavy upon the flesh, the more we press on into the mystery, the less darkness there is. And we find that the darkness belongs to this world and not to the eternity. Then we may ask, why are we placed here with this peculiar restriction? Why are so many people living and dying without believing in light? How is it that we struggle from day to day on massive unsophisticated purposes? How is it that we continue to follow little patterns that lead nowhere and are perfectly content to waste our years rather than to grow? Why do these things happen? And the Egyptians and the Persians and the Hindus have given us a good answer. They have pointed out that we are here just as the small schoolboy says, why do I have to go to school every day when I'd rather go fishing? This is it. We would rather have fun. We would rather do nothing important. We would rather lazily go along, doing as we please, and hoping that everything will come out well. But it doesn't. And it doesn't come out well because it is contrary to the plan of our own existence. The great mystery school, the great center of initiation for man, is the human world itself with all that it contains. This earth is our secret house, where we must learn how to attain our own conscious immortality. We are here to learn, to grow, and to pass through the rites of life. And these rites are basically three. The rite of youth and childhood is the first. The rite of maturity is the second. And the rite of age is the third. We move from one level of the mystery to another. And in each level, there are lessons to learn. Those who learn the lessons graduate. Those who do not learn the lessons continue to drift along in their uncertainties.
So in the great cycle of rituals, as broken up into the year, into the day, into the hour, into the minute, all these divisions are significant and have been made into parts of theology by our remote ancestors who lived and struggled and learned and died long before our time. But always the mystery was the same. Always the rite was the same. The purpose of life was to grow. The purpose of life was to release the light from within, so that instead of depending upon the reformations of physical society, we redeemed ourselves. As Paul says, the Christ in you, the hope of glory. It is our own inner divinity that must shine forth and lead us on the way of righteousness. We look everywhere for leaders, but the leader we never seem to look for is always here in our own heart. And it is this leader that speaks to us sometimes faintly through conscience, and often is silent for many years. Very often in tragedy and great loss, we turn to this inner leadership, and then we discover that there is balm in Gilead, that from this inner life comes the peace, the security, the understanding, which redeems and regenerates the uncertainties of mortality. So here we are with the presence of the Sovereign Son that Akhenaten represented as rays of light, each ending in a human hand. The Son that was no respecter of persons. The Son that was not an autocrat, but was as mindful of the sparrow's fall as it was of the collapse of empire. This ever-present, utter intimacy of life. This life which is a seed, so to say, planted in everything, and growing in everything, unless the thing in which it grows turns against it. And all this life has no cash value. It is far more important. We cannot buy it, we cannot sell it. But we can bestow something of it from our own hearts if we so desire. We can comfort, we can help to enlighten, we can serve generously the needs of life. But we cannot buy or sell the light of heaven. It does not come out of our intellectualism. It does not come out of our materialism. It is not to be found in the laboratories of science. But the base materials of it are everywhere. And there is nothing that man ever learns, ever studies, or ever believes that in one way or another is not an instrument of eternal light. So on Christmas we come as when the sun moves northward, when the darkness of winter begins to break, and we look forward to the promise of another day. We are reasonably certain, even in our most pessimistic moments, that the sun will rise, that the winter will break, that the tiny green things will break through the earth again, that nature will be fruitful, and the human being will be mindful. All these changes are part of a great procedure, a great process. And this process is mentioned in the story of the mysteries of the pyramid, in the house of the hidden places. The pyramid is the symbol of this earth, for its chambers and its inner parts are also symbols of the mysteries of our physical existence. Every mood we have is a room. Every conviction that we nourish puts walls around us or opens them. Every wall is either a divider or a protector. Everything we do has in some way a sacred significance, either directly or by lesson. We learn by doing it well, we learn by doing it poorly. In both cases, learning is inevitable. So as we stand now on the dawn of a very difficult age, a time in which most of our hopes are clouded by the uncertainties that are occurring, when it's sometimes very difficult to keep faith with Providence, to keep our hearts and minds dedicated to those values which are so necessary, in these days to understand the mystery of the annual birth of the Son, it seems to be especially important. In a few days now, the sun will move northward. When it does so, it will give us the promise of another year. We will make our mistakes, but the grass will grow. We can make all the mistakes we want, but the birds will sing. And we will also make terrible times, but little lives will come into birth through us. Everywhere the great plan goes on, and the human being either forwards it or detracts from its fulfillment. But no matter what we do, good, bad, or indifferent, the great plan goes on. It is larger, deeper, and more mysterious than any obstacle that we can build against it. It goes on. Goes on fulfilling itself. In old times, the priesthoods of the ancients were groups of dedicated persons united to help the good word go on, to help to make life rich, to bring new persons to the understanding of the great integrities of existence. And out of all these integrities, we've had the commandments of every culture, laws of ethics, rules, rites, and ceremonies. And in ancient times, people were a little bit intimidated because they were told that if they broke these rules, they would suffer. Now, the suffering usually consisted in being rejected by their fellow citizens, but this was not the real meaning of it or the significance of it. Those who break the rules suffer because they have broken the rules. They suffer because it is inevitable that when we are not consistent with the laws of that light in which we exist, when we cut it off, when we turn our backs to it, when we deny it, or try to corrupt and pervert it into some selfish purpose of our own, then we bring down the strange power that changes the light, as Bainey says, into a consuming fire. Therefore, light is the basis of our growth, and fire is the basis of our purification, as the alchemist pointed out. Every day we are here, we are being tested, not based on by some arbitrary power, but by our own needs. Within ourselves there are hungers, there are pains, there are mistakes that we constantly suffer from. We wish we didn't make them, but we do. We wish we could get over making them. We can, but we may not. Actually, the whole of our existence is a great initiation ritual. And the grand master of the mysteries is the Son, the great Hierophant who controls all the rites and all the symbols. Not the visible sun as we see it in the sky, but as what the Emperor Julianus called the mystery of the sovereign sun and the mother of the gods. The sovereign sun is the ruler whose laws cannot be disobeyed. This is a luminosity. We do not see its principles. But the whole mystery of light is, as Newton found out, completely mathematical, completely lawful. In light is all things. And this light that comes from above, reflected through all forms of creation, turned and crossed over the orbit of the moon, and finally coming down to our earth. This light is a complete work in itself. It is a manuscript with more pages than have ever been written. It is a teacher that teaches more than any sage has ever known. It is a parent more intimate, more kindly, more loving than any physical parent can possibly be. And out of the great eternity of condition, out of the infinite number of things that must be rectified, in this light there is nothing failing, nothing overlooked. The light can reach to the furthest star and into the soul of the tiniest grain of sand. All of it is part of the tremendous dynamic effulgency of this light content. It is something that is so tremendous that we can only see the fringes of its robes. Its own substance is beyond us. So on Christmas Day, we worship, venerate, or adore, in one form or another, by one faith or another, by one system or another. The same mystery, the infinite blessing of God's gift of life, of light, of hope, of faith. And these things are indigenous. They are within us. They are not something that have to be taken out of the pages of a holy book. They are in our own hearts. And there, they are available to us at all times. But we celebrate this availability by the great birth of light at Christmas and the resurrection of light at Easter. These are the ancient ceremonies, the ancient symbols. And now, with all the problems that we face, it is necessary for us to begin to examine a few of these things. We are surrounded by an infinite amount of abuse. Every resource we have is being threatened. The peace and happiness of mankind is in doubt. We are very much aware of our infirmities, but not aware of the remedy. The remedy lies in the very fact of light itself, lies in the fact that our adoration for the eternal should be so much greater than our fear of the temporal, that we cannot be moved from the foundation of gratitude, understanding, love, and obedience. The law of life is like a parent. We must obey. We must, in one way or another, keep the rules of the game. When we do, we are in a magnificent life of peace and security. When we break the rules, disaster descends upon us. We are beginning now, after a number of years of disaster, to consider this matter. We are beginning to feel that there is some relationship between the sky and the infinite and the stars and the sun and the moon and our little puny existence down here on a little ball rolling through space. We begin to realize that we are citizens of a vast universe whose rules we must obey. And we are here not simply to conquer this universe. We are here not to take its resources and exploit them. We are not here to get rich off of what nature has provided. Because if we were, and it was lawful, we would not have to leave all of it behind when we go. We can only take with us that which we have achieved in union with life itself. And so on this season, the experience of light, the experience of life, should be very close to us. And it is properly represented by generosity, by the individual sharing instead of hoarding, the individual giving instead of taking, the individual who realizes that it is better to love than to be loved. This all is part of a great story, a great reality. And the whole hope, the whole principle of it, the whole privilege of it, is returned to us through the mystery of the winter solstice. Here, a necessary extra something is bestowed. In the winter, the world is like the body of things. It is like our physical bodies. In the darkness of winter, the bodies become objects of fear, the objects of abuse, the objects of terror, and crime stalks the darkness. In the light, however, the body becomes a symbol of radiance and luminosity. If we are limited to the body, we dwell in night. If we sustain our realities and survive the mysteries of our problems, then we ascend from body into unity with life itself. There is only one life. Therefore, there can be only one creature. And all the infinite diversities that we know, from the greatest to the smallest, are parts of one eternal family, a family that is forever here, a family in which we can have good relations or bad relations, according to our own conduct. This is a family which we have not yet discovered to be a brotherhood or a sisterhood. We are not sure that those far away understand us, and probably they don't. But it is also true that the law says they must, and we must. There is no end to problem, no solution to the mystery of existence, except the restoration of the unity of life and the realization of the oneness of all created things. This means that all our natural resources must be used lovingly and unselfishly, that we are not permitted by nature to amass anything that is destructive to another person, that we are not allowed to be selfish with impunity. Everywhere we turn, the law works, and the law is love. And without that law, the great realities can never be revealed to us. We will invent many things and abuse them because we have no love. We will do much in research into the depths of nature, but it will be for profit and not for principle, and all will fail. Every device that we invent as a commodity, a convenience, or a new revelation of skills will remain a danger, a hazard, and a constant problem until it is used as the eternal demands that it be used. We cannot use it any other way and survive. And we have to do the same thing with our own lives. If we maintain our grudges and antagonisms, if we find a certain satisfaction in hurting the feelings of others, if we blame others for all our troubles and all our misfortunes, and pass on to other public officials answers that we must find for ourselves, these things continue to be a problem. We cannot be saved by government. But we can gradually restore the government of the eternal over the temporal. We can restore the government of light. And Timur Shah, the great Muslim conqueror, whom we know as Tamerlane, when he became master of the world of his time, he called in his sage and his astronomer and said, "I want you to design for me a government based entirely upon the government of the heavens. I want to have a cabinet. I want to have a solar system of leaders. I want constellations of technicians and of skilled people. I want everything there is in the solar system set forth as a department of human society." It was a great challenge, but there was something in it that probably even Tamerlane did not understand. But the mysterious dark sage who he communicated with set him up a pattern that did survive for some time, a pattern based upon the fact that all parts of a solar system or all parts of a government must be united in a common purpose, and that all of the different branches must be equally enlightened, equally dedicated, and equally desirous of sharing all that is necessary for the common good. This was a great idea and a great challenge, but it comes back to us today. We are gradually, in spite of ourselves, deciding to return the world to its creator. We cannot handle the situation. We were never intended to. We were intended to use the experiences of this world to learn how to handle ourselves, how to become real people, how to do all the things that were necessary to the improvision of realities. And in failing to do this, we have come in time to a grave difficulty. And so on Christmas at this time, we hope that each one of you will be given special consideration to the problem of growth. That by the time we get around to next Christmas, there will be more stars in the terrestrial firmament. That more people will be bound together by the great truths of life. Otherwise, we will find a very strange chemistry occurring. We will find that the instruments for the manifestation of life will gradually deteriorate. the channels will no longer be clear. There will be various stoppages. There will be cholesterol in the psychological arteries of humanity. We will get to the point where we cannot get the blood to the heart, where then we begin to watch the saddest thing of all. Not a sudden departure from here, but a gradual loss of those virtues and values which are most necessary to our personal well-being and to our collective existence.